I wanted to say something about the remaining two runners. This is actually on. I guess it's on. I'm not going to give full proofs or even a significant part of the proof of either of them. But what I was hoping to do is to explain at least where they come from and say something about some of the things which go into them. So let me start with the K-theory one. So we wanted to show that K0 of A, so just this restricted thing to K0 of A is an isomorphism. This was lemma 3. And so just a reminder that H X to X is minimal. X is finite dimensional compact metric. A is the cross product. And for Y in X closed, A, the capital Y, is the subalgebra of C of X and U C0 of X minus Y contained in A. This is the standard unitary in the cross product. Yes. Yeah, you're right. I have to rule out the possibility of a cyclic permutation of a finite set, because none of this stuff is correct for it. The cross product isn't simple. It's not tertially AF. It is type 1. So to compute the K-theory of A, I'm going to use this one, there's the Pinsker-Boyle-Kolesko exact sequence. And, I guess I don't have room to put it there. It's much more general. I might as well put down the general version. For alpha in the automorphism group of some theta algebra A0, it's a six-term exact sequence, like the one you get from a short exact sequence of theta algebras. K0 of A goes to K0 of A, A0. K0 of C star of Z A0 alpha. And then simply K1 of everything. And this map is identity minus alpha inverse star.
Oh,
they're all A0. Right, I don't want to confuse the notation over there. So I don't have an A in here at all.
Yes,
they're the same. So I mean that's similar to what I have here. So I have K0 of the original algebra twice and a particular map, which is the identity minus the map induced by the automorphism. This thing comes from, in the original proof, it comes from an extension. Zero to K tensor A to something T, which I'll have to explain in a moment, to C star, and I should put an A zero here, sorry, C star of Z A zero alpha to zero. And here, so before defining T, I want to introduce some notation using its definition. S is the unilateral shift, say, on little l2 of non-negative integers. So it sends the nth standard basis vector to the n plus first one. Then C star of S is known as a triplet algebra. It fits in an exact sequence. Zero to the compact operators on this Hilbert space to C star of S to the continuous functions in the circle. So the point is that this S is a Fredholm operator. It's essentially unitary. Well, by the compact operators, you get an actual unitary. The tension does not split. And then we take T, and I should put one thing up here. Label both of them, I guess. We take T in C star of S tensored with this cross product. Is the C star algebra generated by things of the form 1 tensor A for A in A0 and S tensor U, where U is the standard unitary. So it looks more or less like the cross product, except that the standard unitary in the cross product has been replaced by a non-unitary isometry. I should warn you that C is not quite the obvious map that won't work. Right, it's not the inclusion. Is not quite the inclusion of K tensor A0. You have to, but it is on, let's say, E0 tensor A for A in A0, and this is the projection on the zero standard basis vector. If I take an EJ here, for example, I have to conjugate, I have to basically apply the automorphism, alpha to the J, I mean alpha to the minus J. And then for a matrix unit, I have to multiply by that U to some power on one side and to some other power on the other side in order to get things to come out right. So a key point is that the map A to 1 tensor A from A0 to T is an isomorphism on K-theory. So over here, this is K0 of K tensor A. This is K0 of T. And then you have to figure out when you identify both of those with K0 of A, what does T turn into? And this is what it turns into. Now assume if A0 is unital, then identity minus alpha star inverse of the class of the identity of A is 0. Right, the identity is fixed by the automorphism, if there is one. So this means it is the image of a class in K1 of the cross product and the class turns out to be the class of U plus or minus, I forget whichever it is. And class of U has infinite order. In particular, if you take the cross product for integers acting on a usual secret algebra, then K1 is never 0. So what happens? So back to our original situation, take A equals C of A0 equals C of X. Is that a question?
Yeah, I lost you that this means
dinner. This class, that one. I'm sorry? Turns out to be this, this class. This means it. Oh, means it is that. Sorry. Means that, I did mistake this. The class of the identity. This class turns out to be plus or minus a class of U. I didn't check which it is. For present purposes, doesn't really matter. So take A0 equals C of X. Then what happens with K0 of A sub K theory of A sub Y? I want the one-point set here. It's the following. That K0 of AY to K0 of A is an isomorphism, and K1 of AY to K1 of A is injective with co-kernel isomorphic to the integers and generated by the class of U. So you notice that U is not in there. Now, it's not obvious that the class of U isn't in K1 of that thing, but in fact it's not. Well, I mean, we've actually seen this, at least one example of this already, namely when we're dealing with the Cantor set, these things with Y compact and open turned out to be AF algebras, and so K1 is obviously 0. And when I take the one-point set, then it's a direct limit of such things, so it's still AF, and so K1 is again 0. So the proof of this, this is gotten by, so the known proof is to combine two papers of Putnam, and it uses the groupoid interpretation, or uses the subgroupoid of, or the subgroupoid A. Well, for actually for any, it's a capital Y for any Y. Now, I suppose, have spent this lecture talking about groupoids. I didn't prepare my notes to do that. If I change my mind to do that now, I will get various little things mixed up. There's a limit to what I can do. The subgroupoid interpretation is essential if one proceeds to Z to the D actions, even on the Cantor set. But unless people actually want to see that specifically, I was going to say a little bit more here and then go on to the other lemma, the one about tracial rank 0 for A sub Y. Especially as, I guess, Berndt, you've dealt with groupoids a lot, but the others probably haven't. So one thing that I tried to do, one might be able to get a different proof using something like the Pinsker-Volkowski method. On an exact sequence, and so I didn't have time to figure out exactly whether this completely works. In any case, even if I did, then I would be what I would do would have to do would in particular include a proof of the Pimsleur-Voiculescu exact sequence. And this is, I mean, it's not really all that hard, but it would certainly take a while. That would also take the full period, or more than the full period. But in any case, so if I is an ideal in A0, and here I is C0 of X minus Y, then you get a subalgebra J in K tensor A, J sub I, let's say, and a subalgebra T sub I contained in T. And I'll tell you what the generators here are. T sub I is generated by all 1 tensor A with A and A0, and the cross product is generated, where was it? What is the definition of T? It's here. Cross product is generated by U and the elements of A0. So I'm just going to simply replace here U by things U times F, or let me say, F tensor UA with A in I. And there's still have A mapping to E0 tensor A from A0 to J sub I. And this map is isomorphism on K-theory. Actually, when I did that, I got an alpha of A here. And this is now I not all of A0, but just I. I wrote on the wrong blackboard there, but anyway. And then you get a commutative diagram of exact sequences. Let me call it the C star algebra generated by A0 and UI. So this is AY in our case. K tensor A. T. C star of G A0 alpha. Okay, so now then, the Pimsoll-Michaelescu exact sequence is the exact sequence in K theory that comes from the bottom row, and then you look at the exact sequence in K theory which comes from the top row, and you still have to prove, and this is the thing which will actually involve some work, and I don't know for sure this is true because I've actually carried it out, although in the particular case that we're dealing with, in this case with Y1.7, more or less has to be true because we already know the result. This map, certainly the map to A0, rather, the map from A0 factors through this one. And so presumably this is an isomorphism on K-theory. And so then one will get two things like this. Say stretch them out and write arrows going down. So you'll have two long exact sequences. With maps between them, which make the diagram commute. And you can use this to get from one place to another. And in particular, if the Y consists of a single point, then the isomorphism, so these are both, this is K0 of I, and this is K0 of X. And you'll lose the class of the identity and not anything else. And in K1, you won't lose anything at all. And that more or less sort of explains why over here on the K1, one loses something because that's what's next to K0 of this. And on the K0, you don't lose anything. So this is sort of an extended exercise to try at home, is to actually carry out this proof and see if it really works, in particular for more general sets Y, or even in this context where I simply have an ideal in a C-star algebra. I have actually, there should be more general versions even than that which might be useful. In particular, there should be some sort of version which works for actions of Z to the D. The resulting things would apply in some places where Putnam's argument doesn't apply. On the other hand, also Putnam's result will apply in some places where this doesn't work very well. So that's more or less what I have to say about that. Questions? Comments? If you do decide to try it, let me know. One thing which I think one ought to be able to get is an exact sequence to compute the K-theory of fairly general subgroupoids of a transformation group groupoids for actions of not only the integers, but of Z to the D. Okay. So I'm not sure how much sense this really makes, but at least I hope you get some idea of the what's involved.
I got a bit lost here.
Yeah.
Talking about actions of death would be, and there's only you here.
So what one should, so here's what I suspect one should do, and this really is some sort of a research project, is if I have an action of Z to the D, then I want to go up here, and I want to change this to the tensor product of D copies of this Hilbert space. I'll have D canonical unitaries, and I want to take S1 tensor U1, S2 tensor U2, and SD tensor UD. And now, this isn't the way one normally computes the K-theory of a cross product by Z to the D. You simply iterate the Pinsker-Weichel-Lescu-Lutard sequence, doing them one at a time. And whatever actually comes out in the end is going to be messy. I mean, it can't be, the answer can't be any simpler than what you get from iterating the Pimser-Weichel-Lescu exact sequence.
And then for iterating, so if you can write the group as a chain of normal subgroups, you can iterate the cross product of the same.
Yes, process. Yes. Let me be a little bit careful. It's not, if you iterate it simply as a chain of normal subgroups, you need a generalization of the cross product. You need something called twisted cross product in a particular form introduced by Phil Green, which is related to some things with about co-cycles and so on. But in this case, the situation is if you have an iterated semi-direct product construction, so that the quotient group of each normal subgroup by the previous one is actually already sitting inside your group, and therefore already acting on the algebra, then you can iterate procedures like this. On the other hand, if you actually try to do it in practice, then you end up dealing with spectral sequences and so on, if you actually want to write down a general answer. Somebody actually did this in some particular context of who went to the talk by Ken Davidson about this very special case of two graph algebras? If you do that very special case with an n graph instead of a two graph, then you will essentially be doing the same kind of, you'll be essentially iterating cross products by Z. And it gets messy, and somebody actually wrote down some sort of computation for this, but it involves spectral sequences and the like. You also cannot simply refer to a particular subset of X. That will not work anymore. Even if you take more general subgroupoids of the integer action, you will have to have you'll have to have not just an ideal in A0, but you'll have to have an ideal I sub n for each n, and they'll satisfy some sort of compatibility conditions. In this context, I1 is alpha of I, I2 is alpha of I, intersect alpha squared of I, and so on. So it will get, the situation is complicated. But my belief is something is that probably it works at least, and that some reasonable result can be gotten out at the end. Doing this particular case, I think, should simply be a matter of modifying what's found in the Pimser-Weichel-Lescu paper, and should be relatively easy. And if I find time to do it, maybe it will end up in the notes. Maybe it won't. It also depends on how soon. The notes are eventually supposed to appear in with some other lecture notes somewhere, and it depends on how soon they really want them. Other questions about K-theory? One reason for not going into this too deeply is that probably K-theory wasn't talked about that much early in the course. But I mean, many things that one does with C-star algebras now involve K-theory one way or another. You can't really get away from it. Okay, let's go on to lemma 4. And I will start with some, again, I want to give an idea of what actually happens. This is where the business about recursive homogeneous algebras becomes important. So lemma 4 said this. It says if the affine function, the K0 of A, not the A, but just the one-point algebra. Affine functions on the trace space of A, Y, has dense range, and this point Y is generic. This assumption is probably not needed, but for the purpose of proving the theorem, we only need that there exists such a point. And so, then A, little y, has tracial rank 0. So you probably, true for all y, prove the main theorem, need only for one y. But remember, I had a point y which I moved around, and that was arbitrary in the proof that I gave. I should also say at this point that, I hope that when I wrote down those lemmas, it looked at least plausible that given them, it's not very much further to go to actually modify the proof, and I wasn't intending to actually describe that part. What I want to do is, what I was intending to do was to tell you what goes into this and give some of the background. And again, I mean, there's a break in 15 minutes, and I can change things on request. Okay, so for the background for this, I want to tell you about simple AH algebras. There are three results. So let A be a simple AH algebra. So this is a direct limit of direct sums of homogeneous algebras. Definitions actually vary. But this is one version of the definition of an AH algebra. I take a direct limit over n of things which are finite direct sums of continuous functions from compact metric spaces into various finite matrix algebras. A more general version is to take a corner of this by a projection. The effect of this is to allow locally trivial bundles with that fiber instead of trivial bundles, as I wrote here. Also, I've seen definitions in which these are restricted to being finite complexes or things like that. To some extent, these definitions are equivalent, at least in the simple case. With small or no dimension growth. And so let me just say what no dimension growth is. It just means that the soup over n and k of the dimension of x and k is finite. And again, this is the covering dimension. It's the same one which was used in the hypotheses of the theorem, of the main theorem. I'll tell you a little, I don't want to write down the fully general definition of slow dimension growth. I'll write down the special case when I get to it. And then these have the following properties. One, the order on order on projections over A is determined, I should have said unital here. Determined by traces. So this means PQ in MN of A, tau of P bigger than tau of Q for all tau in P of A implies that Q is a subprojection of P, equivalent to 1. Two, stable rank of A is 1, and 3, the real rank of A is 0, if and only if the projections on A distinguish the traces. Projections in A distinguish traces. In other words, if you have two traces and they agree on all the projections, they actually agree. By the way, if this condition fails, then the algebra can't possibly have real rank 0, because if it has real rank 0, then linear combinations of projections are dense, and therefore any two continuous linear functionals which agree on all the projections have to agree. So these in turn come from three results about C of X MR, which are the following. The numbers here are not supposed to match the numbers there. You need several of these for each of those. One of them is that if P in C of X MR has large rank, and I'm not going to say exactly how large, but I'll tell you roughly how large in a moment, But I want to say this means point-wise. So if I have a projection that I can evaluate at each point x, I get just a projection in some matrix algebra, I can look at its rank. Then P has a trivial subprojection and this is one Murray von Neumann equivalent to a constant projection. So if you've seen vector bundles where this is really a theorem about vector bundles, it says if you have a vector bundle over X of large rank, then it's got a subbundle which is a trivial bundle, a non-zero trivial subprojection. Two is if, what order did I put them in here? I seem to have run over one page of notes without even looking at it. Oh no, okay, I'm at the bottom of the next page. If P and Q have large rank, and P direct sum E is equivalent to Q direct sum E, or sum E, then P is equivalent to Q. So this is cancellation. But not in general, just if P and Q have large enough rank. And three, if rank of P of X minus rank of Q of X is large for X, then Q is equivalent to a subprojection of P. So this is cancellation, subprojection, and here this is extracting trivial projections. So, I guess I was intending to do two things. One of them, I will talk about the proof of one here. And I'll give you a sort of an outline of that and how it follows from things here. Oh, sorry. Here, large means roughly, it's not as large as you might be thinking, roughly bigger than or equal to half the dimension of X. And the exact number depends on which one of the things it is. X bound varies. For one of them, I have to add a half or one or something like this. It's a half because we're looking at complex vector bundles, whereas dimension is counted in real terms. The same kinds of things are all true if you use real things, but then you have to delete the half. And the same kinds of things are even true if you use quaternionic bundles, and then you get to put one-fourth. So let me illustrate how to prove one for A using results on C of X MR. For that one, this is the easiest one, and I will use only this, and I also don't need to assume simplicity. suppose? So let's keep the notation simple. For simplicity. Not in the same sense there. I read a review in the bulletin of the AMS some time ago about a book with the title Simple Noetherian Rings, and the comment in one of the comments in the review is that, well, perhaps it should have been called Complicated Noetherian Rings. But they were indeed simple in the sense of having no non-trivial ideals. So assume for simplicity that A is the direct limit of C of xn, mr of n. So I'm assuming only one sum end in that expression there. And the maps phi mn of the system are injective. And here, so dimension growth means that the limit then goes to infinity of dimension of xn divided by r of n is 0. So the matrix sizes grow more slowly than the matrix sizes grow faster than the dimensions of the spaces. This thing here, you have to take something like you have to take the worst values of this over each term in the direct sum and take the limit of those. Okay. So I guess I'll do this and then I'll stop for a break. Let PQ be an A. And I want to show that if Q is not sub-equivalent to P, this implies that there exists a trace tau in P of A such that tau of P is less than or equal to tau of Q. So this is the contrapositive of this condition here. Equivalence of projections, and by cutting off some terms in the system, I'm going to assume that P and Q are the images of P0 and Q0 in the zeroth term. And I'm going to let PN, QN be the images in C of XN, MR of N. Okay, then, well, it's not the case that QN is sum equivalent to PN. Therefore, this thing fails. So there is a constant M. I didn't say exactly what it is, but it's about 1/2, such that the inf over x in xn of rank P of x minus rank of Q of x divided by dimension of Xn is less than or equal to m for all n. Right? If this is number is actually bigger than or equal to m times the dimension of Xn, and m is not bigger than a half, then this condition 3 applies and tells you that Qn is subequivalent to Pn, and therefore Q is subequivalent to P, by simply by taking the image out in the end of the direct system. So I will choose Xn in Xn such that the rank of P of I should put n here, right? Pn and Qn. Right, because I'm looking at the thing in Xn. In C of Xn tensor, whatever matrices it was. Rank of Pn of Xn minus rank of Qn of Xn is less than or equal to m dimension of Xn for all n. Then take F in C of Xn, M R of N, 1 over R of N, trace of F of Xn is a state on C of Xn, M R of N. Use Kahn-Banach to extend to a state omega n on A. This is where I'm using the fact that the maps of the system are injective, because I want to claim that C of Xn, this thing is a subalgebra of A. Right, it's unital, so all I need to extend it to is something of norm 1, and with omega n of 1 equals 1. Right, and then it's automatically a state. Let tau be a weak star limit point of the omega n, since omega n restricted to C of xn MR of N is a trace, and the union over N of these things is dense. It's not hard to show that tau is a trace. That parenthesis was supposed to be like that. Omega n restricted to the subalgebra. Yeah. No, I would close that parenthesis. Big one supposed to match this intermediate sized one here. Sorry. So now, So now we note that omega n of P minus omega n of q. No, this is of course the trace of pn minus the trace of qn. So this is equal to rank of pn of xn over r of n minus rank of qn of xn over r of n. And this is less than or equal to m times dimension of xn over r of n. That goes to zero by the four-dimension growth hypothesis. So tau of p minus tau of q is less than or equal to zero. Well, be careful. Let's see. I guess there's enough separability around to claim there actually is a subsequence of these omegas which actually converges to tau. But in general, when you take limit points over nasty sets, you might not get a subsequence. Okay, but anyway, this is the conclusion. Tau of p is less than or equal to tau of q for some tau. Yeah. Yes. That's all. That's all I really need. Yeah. I don't really need a sequence here. Okay. So this is the end of that argument. So in part, I just want to show why four-dimension growth is important. And I should now say, by the way, there are examples which show that if you drop the condition on four-dimension growth, then the conclusion is false. Examples originally due to Jesper Willesen, but Andrew Toms has made lots more and in some ways more impressive examples. And in fact, basically, I think it's basically known from his results that you really can't weaken the four dimension growth condition at all. Okay, so I will stop for a break, and then I'll try to tell you about recursive subhomogeneous algebras. And I'm going to have to tell you, in order to make sense out of that, I'm going to tell you something or other about the proof of, and I really should have kept this board. Tell you something about the proof of 3. Although, again, not in detail. Well, okay, I'm not going to repeat everything I said before forgetting to put the microphone back on, but... I didn't go very far, literally. So I should actually write down the examples so that I can mention those. So example, x, 0 is s d minus 1, h is the identity, then x is the ball. Example, x0 is a point. There's only one possible h. And x is ball mod boundary, which is the d plus 1 sphere. D here, yes. Thank you. Yes, D here, D minus 1, yes. That's right. Tempted to use SD in the ball dimension D plus 1. On the other hand, I want the space to have dimension D. So that's why I shifted the notation. So, since this is an inductive procedure, we assume that PQ in C of X MR are given, and that we have shown that Q is a sub and the rank of P of X minus the rank of Q of X large for all X. And we have already accomplished our goal on x0. So we have v in C of x0 mr such that V, okay, I guess I want to call it V0. V0, such that V0 star V0 is less than or equal to P restricted to X0, and V0, V0 star is equal to Q restricted to X0. And we want to extend over the new cell that we added but by using the H over there, which is called an attaching map, we can assume V0 is defined. So this V0 is telling you that I know that is Q restricted to X0 is already known to be equivalent to a subprojection of P restricted to X0. Let me go back then. So this is the induction step of something. I want to prove this condition 3. I'm going to start over a 0 cell, which is the first thing that I do. That's just a point where it's trivial. And then I simply add cells one at a time. And I assume that I have my projections defined in the whole space, and I construct my sub-equivalents one step at a time. Sorry. So I'm assuming then that I've got it on the space x0, and I want to extend it over the space x. So we assume that b0 is defined on the boundary of this ball. Now, I'll point out that, right, so I'm really using v0 composed with h here. And it doesn't matter really here, since I could have used simplicial complexes, but I want to point out anyway that I'm not assuming that h is injective, and therefore in particular I could have taken sort of one value and spread it out over the whole boundary. That would have happened in this example here, where I'm attaching the thing to a point. Okay, so now I have something defined in the boundary of the sphere, and I want to extend it over the sphere. So the obstruction is almost happy group. To extending is an element of sum of pi d minus 1 of something. And I don't really want to write down exactly what the something is, but it should at least be plausible. And if rank of p minus rank of q, and I won't bother to put p of x minus rank of p of x minus rank of q of x here because the space is connected. Looking over is big enough, is bigger than roughly d over 2, this homotopy group is 0. I still want to leave that, I guess. Homotopy group is 0. This is a slight oversimplification. The actual proof that I have written down somewhere is extend V one dimension at a time. And so what's really 0 is something where you have rank 1 somewhere, and where the V's that I'm starting with are on one-dimensional spaces rather than on arbitrary dimensional spaces. But that's a sort of minor point. So this proof, by the way, is basically already found in a book, Who's Your Mother's book on fiber bundles. And the point I want to make about it is it is done by induction over the cells and depends ultimately only on some vanishing homotopy group. So someone has to compute the relevant homotopy groups. And this is, of course, a problem in algebraic topology. The other ones are done essentially the same kind of method. But now you see that this proof is, the same proof is going to work for the recursive homogeneous case. So for recursive subhomogeneous case, again, there are reductions here. I'm going to reduce through. And now one has to, I mean, there's some technicalities which I'm suppressing, but which are have to do with approximation of spaces by finite complexes and the like, reduce to suppressing some technicalities. P, Q are in A, which is equal to A0 direct sum over C of S D minus 1 MR, C of BD R, sorry, MR. The rank RP minus rank of Q is large on BD. We have V0 in A0 such that with P0, Q0 being the restrictions, I'll put restriction in quotation marks, but really they're in this direct sum, and so we project onto the first coordinate. Restrictions to A0, so really projection onto first command. Let's see. Oh, I made a mistake. I should have used that board there. I'll go use that one next. So we're supposed to already, again, it's an inductive procedure. We're supposed to already accomplish our task in A0. So that means there is V0 in A0 such that, same formula as before, V0, V0 star is Q0, sorry, I got them in the wrong order, V0 star, V0 is less than or equal to P0. Okay? And then we simply look at the image. Of V0 in C of S D minus 1 MR. Right, that's the map from here to here. Right, we had rho A0 to, no, that wasn't rho, this was phi, A0 to C of S D minus 1 MR, and rho C of B D MR to C of SD minus 1 MR is the restriction. This is rho, that's our phi of V0. And now we have the required sub-equivalence on SD minus 1. We have to extend over BD. But now we have exactly the same homotopy vanishing result. Use the same homotopy vanishing result. Before. So, I mean, when I look back at the proof of this in Husemiller's book, as soon as I saw this proof, I realized, yes, of course it's going to work for recursive homogeneous algebras. Yes. So my point is, I mean, part of what I want to illustrate here is what's good about recursive homogeneous algebras. And in this connection, it should be mentioned that there exist subhomogeneous algebras, even where all of the irreducible representations have dimension less than or equal to 2, which are not recursive homogeneous algebras. It's not completely trivial to construct such a thing, but they do exist. On the other hand, they don't play any role in the particular theorem or particular result I want to describe, because I'm using things about the dimensions of the base spaces. And if you take the space of irreducible representations for each dimension, it's locally compact Hausdorff, assume separability to avoid some possible problems. If those are all finite dimensional, which you need anyway in order to make that work, then in fact the algebra is recursive homogeneous. I have two papers of which I just got reprints of one of them. It's the second one. This is the result about direct limits. Anybody who wants one is welcome to have it. I don't know why I didn't get the other one, because they were supposed to appear back to back in the same journal. This is the second one. I'm sorry? Cancellation of vector bundles. I mean, the extent to which cancellation holds has been a problem considered worthy of study in and of itself in both algebraic topology and in purely algebraic situations. And to some extent, that's also true in C-star algebras. I mean, it's considered an interesting theorem if you can prove cancellation of projections holds in such and such a C-star algebra. Whether it was anything beyond that was done with it, I don't actually remember. It was, I think it was at the end of one of the chapters, or near the end of one of the chapters. But I don't remember for sure. I mean, implicitly, it gets used in lots of times in C-star algebras. You want to compute the order on K0. And cancellation is relevant. Okay, so what's actually true? I guess I still want to leave that thing. Let me... recursive subhomogeneous C-star algebras. So item one for homogeneous algebras does not make sense. There might not be any such thing as a trivial projection, because you have trouble gluing them. So remember the building blocks for the Jiangsu algebra. So the set of things F 0, 1 to M R tensor M S R, sorry, F of 0 is in MR tensor 1. F of 1 is in 1 tensor MS. If so, has no non-trivial projections if RAS are relatively prime. So, right, this thing really refers to essentially what you get is a rank one trivial bundle, a rank one trivial projection, and there aren't any rank one trivial projections. Right, can't do it. But 2 and 3 are both still true. Hold as stated. And now you want 4, but hold essentially as stated, I should say. Essentially. So what you want is if the base spaces, so remember I have this iterated pullback thing and I have C of X tensor whatever it is in them. So the base spaces are X0 XR, XL let's say, then I want dimension of P of X. So I want large compared to dimension of xk for points in xk. So if I do my recursive homologous decomposition, for example, one space might be big and one space might have a very low dimension. A very low dimension, I don't need the rank to be large there, I don't need the difference in the ranks to be all that large there. So that's how it actually turns out. On the other hand, for present purposes, I might as well just say large compared to half the largest of the dimensions. I mean, this is what you can see the inductive proof gives you, right? I mean, but for present purpose. Enough to use bigger than or equal to about half of the maximum over k dimension. That's k. So in direct limits, I should say simple direct limits, with no dimension growth, and it's not clear how to define sole dimension growth. Properly. So this is why I'm restricting to this case. On the other hand, that's what we have, because the base spaces we get are closed subsets of that space capital Y, which in turn is a closed subset of X, and all dimension must be equal to dimension of X. One, the direct limit, you get, order on projections determined traces to single rank one. And three, and here you lose something. You lose something because we lost this item one here, right? That one didn't, this one didn't carry over. And so you have to have a stronger condition is if k K0 of A mapping to affine functions on P of A has dense range associated with that real rank 0, real rank 0, if and only if this thing has dense range. And one can check that for a simple unital C-strand algebra without any other hypotheses, if it has real rank 0, then this map has dense range. Okay, so this is a necessary condition. And it's, you're just sort of fortunate that in the homogeneous case, the condition is simply the projections distinguishing the traces is sufficient. And here it's not. The Jiangsu algebra is a counterexample because since there's only one trace, you don't need any projections at all to distinguish the traces. However, the Jiangsu algebra certainly does not have real rank 0. It has no non-trivial projections. Okay. So the next point is, and now here's where one gets in further trouble. I'm not sure how much of this I'm really going to be able to explain now, but I will try. If A has at most countably many extreme trivial states, and real rank of A is 0, then A has trivial rank 0. And this follows from some general theory. And what I'd like to do is to try to give you some idea of how, why that's an issue, and what one can do about it, specifically for minimal homeomorphisms. I should say, this thing here, this condition basically guarantees the existence of projections. I told you that the projection, or at least a formal difference of projections, which gives you some function. Okay, so let me point out, state now, for later reference, a key lemma in the proof of the real rank of the condition for real rank 0. And is this: suppose A is the direct limit by N, and these are recursive system of recursive homogeneous algebras with no dimension growth, and is simple. Let A, B, C be positive elements of A, K, plus such that AB equals B and BC equals C, then there is just a projection Q further out in the system such that after pushing AB see further out. One has, and assume the dense range condition. That's important. Such that AP equals P and PC equals C. In other words, so think of this as functions, right? A is 1 on the support of B, and B is 1 on the support of C. Okay? Q. So, I mean, the picture is something like this. Better use a different color. T does not have to be 1 anywhere, but of course the interesting cases are when it is. Alright, so this is that's C, this is B, and this is A. So what it says is I can stick a projection in there. And one has to, one of the steps is to figure out, well, roughly what should all the traces be on that projection. And then you use this condition to find a projection with the right traces. And then you use the cancellation and subprojection and so on theorem to push it around so it lies in the right position. I'm making it sound much easier than it is. I mean, it took a few pages to do, but on the other hand, the basic idea isn't new. Something essentially like this already shows up in the proof of the real rank zero condition for the homogeneous case. It got somewhat harder in this recursive homogeneous case, but the principle is the same. Okay, so let's see, should I go on for another 5 or 10 minutes, or should I just simply stop? I might add that in the proof of this, in the actual proof of the induction step, right, I have three such elements here. So basically I've got one thing between A and C, and when I actually carried out the proof in one of the induction steps, I needed to have not just one thing, but seven things between A and C. Don, this sort of thing will be very familiar. So, right, A, B0 is B0, B0, I guess called B1, A, B1 is B1, B1, B2 is B2, and so on, and B7, C is C. Okay. So now I want to go back specifically to A sub Y, where we have minimal homeomorphism. Actually, I don't really need minimality at this point, and I'll state the...
You can put A2 is equal to 2, which means A1 is equal to 2, and A2 is equal to 1 somewhere. But how do you know that A, B, and C are not all
non-1
or some
kind of evidence?
Or A2 be 2?
Oh, first of all, I guess I wanted to say C is not 0. But then, you see, if thinking of them as functions, if B, C equals C, then B equals 1 everywhere on the support of C.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so it's not just that C is less than or equal to B. It's the specific relation here. So morally, even in a C-tree algebra, this implies that B is 1 on the support of C, whatever those might be. Definition. E in X plural. And E is universally null if mu of E is 0 for all H invariant Borel probability measures. Mu. H invariant, yes. I mean, otherwise, right, if I don't say H invariant, then there aren't going to be any such things. Right, and then I guess I cut to the empty set.
Oh, back to the Borel.
Yeah, it's a Borel set, so I don't want to worry about, I don't want the measures to be complete, I just want Borel measures. Yeah, if I don't put H invariant in there, if E contains any point, then I can take the point mass at that point, and obviously the measure of E is then not zero. I should note, it's enough to consider ergodic measures, which are the same as extreme points in the H invariant measures, which is the same as trivial states, is extreme states, extreme points of the trivial state space of the cross product. When H has no periodic points. Right, because I mean. Right, which Klein Milman tells you that all the measures are the measures are in the closed convex hull of the extreme points. Klein Milman plus Ella Oglu. Okay. I want the boundary of Y to be universally null. For reasons I will describe in a moment. If only countably many extreme points, then for all X, for all but countably many epsilon bigger than 0, the boundary of the open ball is epsilon about X is universally null. If I fix one measure, then at most countably many of these things can have non-zero measure. If uncountably many had non-zero measure, then I could find countable subcollections of them such that the measures added up to something arbitrarily large. And I won't actually carry out this argument in detail, but it's not too hard. Okay, so for each particular measure, only countably many of them have non-zero measure. Well, I'm only looking at countably many measures. So only countably many of them have non-zero measure for any of those countably many extreme points. But that's true for all of them. So here's a theorem, which I will not don't have time to describe the proof of. And a theorem is if X is compact metric, H X to X has no has periodic points, has set periodic points of dimension equals zero or empty. What's the right statement? Then for arbitrarily, then there are arbitrarily small sets. Why? And finite dimensional. Right, you also find dimensionality here. Then for arbitrarily small sets, why? Sorry, there are arbitrarily small sets. Why? Such that boundary of Y is universally null. And the proof uses dynamics. Given a point in the neighborhood of that point, given Y in X, U containing Y open, there exists a Y like this. And so then I need arbitrarily small closed sets Y universally, and interior of Y is not empty. There exists Y as above, such that Y is in capital Y, which is containing U. So yeah, I forgot to write two things. First of all, it should be closed. It doesn't really matter. I can take the closure. The boundary can't get any bigger. But I also want the interior to be not empty. It's small in the sense it's contained in a small neighborhood.
Right, but it's small, but no, not. I mean, there's a thing.
Small diameter. I don't mean thin. I don't mean any kind of. I don't mean it to be thin in any sense.
Right.
I want it to be a small neighborhood, basically. Okay. I need one more lemma, and then I'm going to draw a picture of a Roehlin tower, and then I will stop. I make the right statement here. So lemma. Z closed and universally null. Epsilon bigger than zero.